direct any questions to director@1031.org. We are recording this call. Steve, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Lynn, and thank you, everyone, for joining. Now, as you're joining, I know Lynn's repeated this a number of times, but we cannot use a global mute function for everyone on this call, and we have over 100 people joining us. So thank you for joining us. We need you. We need you to understand the threat, and we need your help. So that said, again, mute your phone, please, and if you have to take another call, please hang up. Do not put us on hold. Otherwise, we're going to be treated to a variety of hold music. And while that can be nice, not in this circumstance. So please do that. And then questions. Please do not jump into the conversation with questions. That can be quite chaotic. Please email your questions directly to Lynn. That her email address is in the invitation. Send it to her, and we'll address those questions at the end of the call. So mute. Don't put us on hold. Send questions to Lynn. And we'll remind people of that as we hear people joining the call. So thank you. We want to keep the meeting moving at 1 hour. So I will not filibuster on the front end. I just want to thank Scott Saunders. You worked very hard in putting this together at the last minute. Thank you. Margo and Lucas, same. Lynn, thank you for all of your help on this. This has been this is not an easy task to get something like this put together given the circumstances. And the entire Government Affairs Committee, thank you for all of your work. So today, Dave Franasiak and the team, they're going to frame the threat. This is an unusual threat. This is much different than what we've had in the past. Do not assume that Donald Trump, as a real estate professional, will be on our side. This situation is very complex. There's a great deal of uncertainty around it, and it's a radical rewrite of the way the Treasury collects taxes, administers taxes. The entire code is at risk, and that includes Section 1031, and specifically to us, 1031. So they will frame the threat in more detail. They will talk about what we are doing. We have been very proactive on this, and that's a good thing, and what we still need to do. So as we wrap up the call, we'll talk about a call to action. So as you're listening, please be present. This threat is very real. It's to our everyday lives, our livelihood, and what we've built over decades of qualified intermediaries. This is a serious, serious issue. So at the end of this, we'll talk about that call to action and how we fuel that call to action. And with that, Dave, please take it over.
Hi, Dave Franasiak here. How are you all? I'm sure some of you have heard me speak before, and certainly in the last year or two, I've talked about outlook for 1031, and I've sketched out various scenarios. And the one scenario that I consistently said is the most dangerous scenario is where one party controls all three branches of government, the House, the Senate, and the presidency. This year, it so turned out that the Republicans now control all branches of government. It's a dangerous outcome for the retention of 1031 because it opens the door for the Republicans to use what's known as the budget reconciliation process, which is extraordinarily deliberative in terms of end result, which is there will be legislation enacted. It's on a timetable that's very well prescribed by statute, and you will have a president that will sign whatever is produced by Congress. The Republicans have been in favor of tax reform for a while, and we know from the past that the last attempt at this was the so-called CAMP draft, named after the former head of the Ways and Means Committee, and it simply eliminated 1031. It was scrapped in favor of lower corporate rates. What we have now in front of us is the House blueprint on tax reform produced by the Republicans on the committee, Kevin Brady, with the endorsement of the Speaker, Speaker Ryan. It does not specifically repeal 1031, and it's in the four corners of the document, but we know in talking to all the members of the Ways and Means Committee, the Republicans, some of the Democrats, and having intense meetings with the Ways and Means Committee staff this week, this Wednesday, members of the FBA folks were on the call, were in those meetings. We had a meeting with Barbara Ingus, Ways and Means Committee, and also with George Callis, who is the top tax man for Speaker Ryan, and it's fairly clear that we're in play. We're not out yet, but we have to really, really push back. And again, let me give you the sense of the timetable here. The Trump win and the Republicans rallying around this blueprint document that they came out with under Paul Ryan now feel they have momentum. The Democrats are in disarray, and they're planning on rewriting Obamacare, or a good part of it, in January. Now, normally, Congress swears themselves in January 3rd so they can all get paid. That's important. And then the president becomes the new president, which in this case is Trump, on January 20th. And usually they come in on the 3rd and they leave, hang around, go to the inauguration, and then they sort of get down to business. This year is different. This year they're going to be in on January 3rd. They're going to stay in all of January working on Obamacare repeal. The budget reconciliation procedures are now, there's many of the, it's going to create at least three separate vehicles. There'll be one over FY 2017, which is the current year. They haven't really passed the budget, but they will come back in January, pass the budget, and provide budget instructions to the committees of jurisdiction, Ways and Means, and others to produce something on Obamacare. That will be processed, and there's some hope, and I think it's a long shot, but they could get something through the House and the Senate by Inauguration Day. That's January 20th. Then they're going to be working on the 2018 budget, which, again, a budget resolution just needs to be passed by the House and the Senate. They control both. That's not hard. It's a majority vote. That's not hard. What budget reconciliation does, again, is it gives you a timetable, and the Democrats in the Senate, there's going to be 48 of them, cannot filibuster this budget reconciliation bill. So when they decide to move the tax bill, it'll be a majority vote, majority Republicans in the House, majority of the Republicans in the Senate, and it'll be signed by the president. The last time we used this procedure was for Obamacare. That took a while to get through. The last time we used this for a tax bill was 2001, and we had a bill to the president by May. Now, I'm not saying we're going to have a bill with the president by May, but that's what history shows. It could be before August recess. It could be in September. I think that's the urgency of this. And, again, these votes are just going to be majority votes. Now, we have some things that need to be done first, which is the Trump administration's got to get their people sort of on the field on the tax. The first thing, Obamacare going first is a good thing. It's a good thing because for 1031, because there are tax provisions in Obamacare that will be repealed. If they're repealed, it'll make it easier for the Republicans to do tax reform. That doesn't mean we're off the hook. It just means they have more money to work with to either lower rates or help save 1031 or some of the other provisions that are out there. Once the Trump folks are on the field, they will be negotiating with the House. The Senate will also be negotiating with the House. The Senate does not have a blueprint. They've been looking to Senator Hatch for some guidance, and he's been working on something that's fairly radical called comprehensive tax reform. That being said, this particular House version of this bill that's now on the table is radically different than the CAMP provision, radically different from other tax reform bills, because it doesn't just simply lower the rates and eliminate deductions and deferrals like 1031. What this bill does is three unique factors. One, it eliminates the deductibility of business interests and allows immediate expensing for all assets. And we are faced with an issue where the staff and members are saying, show us that 1031 is needed in that kind of an environment. And we've provided them examples. We lobbied, but it's a hard sell. The other aspect here is they had a 20% import tax or an adjustment on all imported goods, and that's a pay for as well. There is a linkage between the immediate expensing and the disallowance of interest deduction, because if you have an immediate expensing on all assets without a limitation on debt, people would buy property, put all debt on it and 1% equity, write it all off, and it would be a very, very rich tax subsidy that even the Republicans cannot defend. So in order for immediate expensing to stay on the table, they've got to maintain the non-deductibility of interest expense. Any industry that uses debt as a raw material, like real estate, like many financial services companies and the rest, are going to have a really hard time with their business models if you eliminate the deductibility of interest. And think of all the debt that's in real estate and what happens if that suddenly gets unwound. We know that the Trump bill has some overlap with the House Ways and Means Committee bill because they have this feature of immediate expensing, but only for manufacturers, and the non-deductibility of interest if you elect to have immediate expensing as a manufacturer. That being said, we absolutely, the shortened timetable is such that we know that there will be a bill produced. It'll could be produced before August, if not sooner. It definitely will be produced in 2017. It could very well repeal 1031 because these other provisions in the bill, which are unique, like immediate expensing of all assets, including buildings, but not land or dirt. Dirt's not depreciable. Are such that the issues raised whether you need 1031 at all, and we constantly bombarded with that, and we're constantly pushing back. So what we need everybody to do on the phone call is write their congressman, write the tax writers on the two committees. Folks will get into what else can be done to help bolster our effort. Obviously, one of the arguments we're making is the 1031 is needed on equipment. It's needed on buildings. 1031 is certainly needed for land. When you look at who cares about land, land includes farmers, it includes commercial real estate, it includes a variety of other important constituencies. But what we are trying to do is preserve current law 1031, which includes equipment, buildings. And in order to do that, we're going to need everybody's help. If we fail, there's really no coming back. I don't see how we come back to a new 1031. I think we've got to fight to get what we can get in the House bill, and that a good defense is a great offense is the best defense. And in this case, we got to go after the House bill and insist that 1031 be maintained. We then also have to work the Senate, the Republicans and Democrats, to make sure that they remain stalwart on 1031. And again, to speak of the Trump administration, I know that there's some chatter that since Trump is in real estate, therefore he's going to protect 1031. People have to realize this is a really, really big poker game, and Trump wants to be huge. He wants to be successful. He wants tax reform, and if that means that he's got to give up something on real estate like 1031 or other provisions, he will do it in a heartbeat. Why? Well, let me be very practical. A lot of people in real estate are Democrats. Very few, if any of them, supported Trump, and I don't think that any of us want to rely on that being the bailout of 1031, i.e. Trump will come to our rescue. I offer very little, if no hope on that one, just because we are a small player in a very, very, very big chess game involving multinationals and the entire U.S. economy, you know, all $17 trillion of it. So we really need your help. This ain't crying wolf. Something's going to happen this year, and we're either going to be able to continue to generate monies in terms of your business structures, in terms of your model. You're going to be able to maintain that 10 or 15 or 20 years of cash flow under current law, or you're going to have to find a new way of earning a living. I mean, it's just that bad. So I don't want to be an alarmist on this, and this one, we're not crying wolf on this. The last time this happened was 2001. It was a big tax cut. This is the way the 86 bill was put together, was through budget reconciliation, where you can't have people stopping bills and filibustering. So that's my message, and I don't mean to be extraordinarily alarmist on that. I tried to give some substance around it. I'm happy to take questions after my FEA colleagues give their thoughts and comments. And with that, that's my short and sweet presentation.
Hey, Dave, Steve here, just a quick question. Now, Kevin Brady, the current chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, in direct communications with him, he has stated to us that he does not believe that 1031s are necessary given full expensing, correct?
Again, I did not have these conversations. They were had by folks related to the FEA effort and a company in particular. There have been four conversations with Brady over the break. Three of them were sort of plain vanilla, where he came back and he essentially said, you know, we want everything on a postcard. 1031's not going to be mentioned on a postcard, but we want a tax code that makes people do things because of economic outlook and economic result, not because of a certain type of way of doing things to get a certain tax benefit. That's the normal response that we've been getting. We got one response that basically was as follows. Well, we're not quite so sure, because if you have immediate expensing and you have low rates, what do you need 1031 for? You probably don't need it. And then it was a follow-on comment that said the following, but please stay at the table. The meetings we had with his staff, it was fairly direct that they are not moving on immediate expensing and that they are really committed to these lower rates and that we have to make the concrete case on why we need 1031. There wasn't a lot of budging on that. This is the fourth time we met with them, actually, in the last 2 years. It was pretty directed, pretty focused. And I think the meeting back from Speaker Ryan's staff was along similar lines, but he did defer more to the Brady staff and go out on his own and express a view that was contrary to the Ways and Means staff.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. So related to that, I know that the Government Affairs Committee representatives had meetings over the last couple of days with some of the tax writing staff that are charged with taking that House Republican blueprint and converting it to legislative language. Is there anything there that we should share with the membership?
Yes, this is Suzanne. I've got several things, and then I'll turn it over to Brent and Max for their comments. But certainly, when we went in to see the staff for House Ways and Means, it was very clear that they were willing to listen to what we had to say, as long as our comments were focused on how does 1031 fit within the published framework of the blueprint. And the published framework of the blueprint includes expensing. Immediate expensing for all tangible and intangible personal property assets and real estate improvements, but not the land. When I had a conversation several weeks ago with Congressman Roskam, who sits on the committee, and I met with him in district, and he told me that they were really locked in on expensing, that much of the blueprint was negotiable. There were a couple of items that were not, and expensing, somebody's making a lot of noise, so please put your phone on mute. But expensing was one of the items that really was not negotiable. They really are locked in on that. And certainly that was quite evident when we sat down with Barbara Angus and Harold Hancock and Mark Warren. The counsel for majority for House Ways and Means was talk to us about 1031 in the context of the blueprint and in the context of expensing. So in their minds, they were open to listening to 1031 for land, but really nothing else. They did, however, acknowledge that expensing of real estate improvements would be administratively difficult because really the allocation, the value allocation for improvements versus land is really very dynamic. You know, it's not something that is going to stay static because, as every realtor can tell you, it's all about location, location, location. So, you know, the percentage, the ratio is going to change. So that said, we sent out in the packet this morning a set of five talking points about how Section 1031 complements the blueprint for tax reform. Because in our conversations and in yours, meaning all of us, as you write your congressman and talk to them, go to fundraisers so that you can look them in the eye, what we don't want to do is come out opposing expensing because we know that's a non-starter. What we have to do is really focus on why 1031 is compatible with expensing and why it needs to stay and what are the unintended consequences of it going away. Who's left out in the cold? So we've got five bullets here. They're pretty straightforward. They're all on one page. Please read them, familiarize yourself with them, because that is the argument du jour. Along this line, and I'm going to turn it to Brent in a moment to talk to what people can do and what he's been doing. my company, Fidelity National Financial, is a member of the Real Estate Roundtable. And I serve on the Tax Policy Advisory Committee for the Real Estate Roundtable. Chairman Brady has made it real clear that he does not want people coming in and really talking about, oh, just keep my section of the code. He really wants commentary that looks at the big picture. How is my industry disadvantaged by all of these things, or how is it impacted is probably more appropriate. Maybe at the end of the day, it's better. Maybe at the end of the day, it's different but neutral. Or maybe at the end of the day, it's different and worse. But he wants this broader, how does the blueprint in totality impact certain taxpayers? So with that in mind, the Real Estate Roundtable is leading a coalition to engage Price Waterhouse to do a study of the impact of a variety of the blueprint proposals that impact real estate. They're going to look at 8 different types of real estate holdings: an office building, an apartment building, shopping center, warehouse, a hotel, assisted living facility, a resort or timeshare, and just plain land. And if for those different representative forms of real estate investment, and put that together. And so I have proposed to the FEA board that we be a party to this coalition, and fully expect that to happen. The votes are still being counted on that. Brent, you want to talk about what you're doing and your intel?
I'm going to interrupt.
Yeah, go ahead, Lynn.
I'm going to interrupt just a moment. Someone has a fax running in the background. Again, please, please, please put your phone on mute. Thank you.
Yeah, and if somebody may be doubling up a fax line with a phone line, if that is you, please hang up. Thank you.
I think
we're good. Okay, go ahead, Brent.
I'm not going to really reiterate, Suzanne, any of the areas that you touched on. I think one of the areas that people need to become versed with is not only reviewing the particulars of the blueprint of the points around expensing and the give and take, but be familiar with it so you can talk with your clients, speaking to your congressmen. We will have some information provided on 1031, our FEA website, with some language, the white papers, and further language that we can actually provide to our congressmen. One of the things that people forget is every 2 years, a lot of the congressmen change and senators have changed. So if you have written a letter in the last couple years to your congressman, it is absolutely fine to do it again, because it's highly, number one, likely that the staffers have changed. Number two, your congressmen or women have also changed. So the repetitive nature of getting these type of documents in and out from, again, from members of the FEA is extremely important. I want, Max, I don't know if there's anything you want to add to this. I do have a lot of interest of moving to any questions if they're coming in, to make sure we're addressing what the members are looking for or any clarification. But, Max, is there anything you wanted to add?
The only thing I would add, Brent, and I have not been back to those meetings. That burden has been taken on by Suzanne and John and Bill Horan and Mary Cunningham, et cetera. But I think one of the things that I've been concerned about most recently is the fact that, you know, that we've put some money in some what we thought were strategic places, including Kevin Brady. And it's pretty clear at this point in time that there's no loyalty to the FEA. It's also critical, I think, that we end up getting the NAR, Real Estate Roundtable, Realtors Land Institute, a lot of those other coalition members involved in this. They typically are larger than us. They are really kind of a little bit behind the curve. I'm not saying that, you know, in a demeaning way, but that's just the way they are. They're bigger organizations. It takes them a lot longer to get started. So to the extent that, you know, that the members also, FEA members, can contact those types of people and have them begin to put pressure on their national organizations, it would be very helpful. That's basically all I need to say now.
Thank you, Max. Lynn, have we begun to receive questions via email yet?
We have. The first one comes from John in North Wales, Pennsylvania. Would contacting our clients and advisors, in parentheses, lawyers and accountants, be advisable?
Run with that, Brent.
I'll take that as Dave Franciak. Yes, okay. If you feel comfortable enough to let your clients know, particularly if they're longtime 1031 users, the other service providers that are out there, that your team that you work with, absolutely. And again, this time it's for real. This is not some sort of, gee, we might be on a bill as a revenue raiser. This is a rewrite of the code, and we could be left on the cutting room floor. And people have spent a lot of time and effort building up very profitable and important businesses, and this could be a real category killer for us. I don't know how else to say it. And you should go to your members of Congress. You should outreach to others in your business community you feel comfortable doing an outreach to, and write to the members of the Ways and Means and Senate Finance Committee if it's only the two chairmen. You know, let them know that you like what you're doing, you're providing a service, and, oh, by the way, you're doing something very important for the economy. You're helping your clients create jobs and grow their businesses and contribute to capital formation.
You may want to point them also toward 1031taxreform.com for the resources and there to help frame the argument or frame the threat. And also it gives you the ability as well to reach out to our legislators.
Okay. The next question is from Leonard in San Francisco, California. How does a mom-and-pop investor immediately expense their rental property purchase?
Well, that's a great question. I know they're putting the House Republican blueprint into into language now, and eventually it's such a massive task, a radical task, that eventually, like Dave says, that the tax code would be rewritten. But I would imagine that it would administratively to expense something like that would not be unlike current law, where it's simply just a large, in layman's terms, write-off and an offset to taxable income.
And you would have a loss carry forward, an indefinite loss carry forward.
And one of the areas, just to make everyone and to think about this and put a little bit of this in perspective with expensing versus, you know, depreciation versus, you know, this interest deductibility that actually Dave spoke on, is think about interest. And all of our clients use interest, whether it's for real estate 27 and a half years or equipment for 5 years, 7 years. It's a way of depreciating, recapturing the asset over time. So expensing is allowing you to write that off on the year of acquisition, meaning you buy something for $100 as opposed to getting that back over 5 years. You actually get to write it off and recapture it year one. So on your revenue minus basically expenses or acquisitions, it's minus $100. It's just a timing difference. So understanding whether you get $100 back over 5 years or you get it over 1 year, it's just a timing difference. The offset is a real difference. It's a real dollar when you're told you cannot deduct interest expense. So think of that on your personal side. If you are not able to deduct your home mortgage interest, that's a real dollar that you're not able to use back into your business. And so we need to make sure our clients understand the difference and not be caught up with only half the story. We need to fulfill and provide them the full understanding of what these bills are talking about. Lynn, do you have another question?
I do. This is from Debbie in California. Can Dave explain the immediate expensing, how immediate expensing affects the exchanges?
I'll defer to somebody on the FDA to do that because they can do it as well as I can, if not better.
You want to go for that, Brandon?
Well, yeah, just picking up for what I was just saying, immediate expensing, and even what Steve was talking on a little bit, has to do with the year of acquisition or the year placed in service. You're able to write off as an expense that new acquisition. And so it's a direct deduction from your income. And when, and I think either Dave said, you know, a perpetual net operating loss, that basically means that net income is below zero. And that's being able, you're able to carry that forward for, I think it's indefinitely or indefinitely under the new proposal. That means that if, sorry, Dave, go ahead.
No, it's indefinitely. And again, the argument is if you're able to do this and you're able to continue to buy properties, then what do you need to do a 1031 exchange for because you're getting all these write-offs? You don't need the deferral, in other words. That's the argument.
Correct.
Yeah, and if you, Brent, you mind if I jump in real quick? The most simple explanation that I can offer is one I see in the marketplace quite a bit as it relates to equipment, tangible personal property. And the thinking is this, as it applies to real property and tangible personal property. When you sell something under full expensing, and assuming that the House Republican blueprint moves forward and full expensing is there and there's no 1031, there's no like-kind exchange law, that someone disposing of that asset would generate some income, which could be fully offset. That income can be fully eliminated through full expensing available to the acquisition of replacement property. So it's a net zero from a taxable income perspective event, transaction. The sale generates income. Acquisitions generate expenses in excess of the income recognized. Taxable income is zero. Even if the purchases are far exceed that income generated from the dispositions, then there's net operating losses carried forward indefinitely that can be used to offset even future income, future dispositions. So you have this cycle of sale, expense, sale, expense, or income, expense, with consistent taxable income of zero in a vacuum as it relates just to the sale of property and the acquisition of property. That's as simple as I can explain it. You sell something, you generate some income, you buy something, you buy it for enough, you fully expense it, you eliminate that income as a taxable item. That's the conventional wisdom behind it.
Given the reality that very little real estate is bought with cash, it's usually bought with debt and cash. And if the debt's not deductible, in a gross sense, it means the properties you're going to be able to buy will have lesser value since you're not going to be able to leverage yourself up and make the cash flows work. You can't also depreciate land. So if your land is a good part of the total price, you'll never get that expense. You're never going to get that written off. You can only write off the building.
Okay, we'll move on to the next question. There's a suggestion from Stephen in Cincinnati, Ohio, for his, it's easier and more effective for him to call his congressman versus writing a letter. So that's just a piece of advice there. But his question is also, what will happen to current exchanges if this gets repealed?
We don't know.
When they have a major rewrite of the tax code like they did in 86, they have what's known as transition rules where you get transition relief for a period of years. No one's talking about that just yet. Obviously, you're going to need a bridge. Hopefully, we don't have to think of one or go there. Hopefully, we'll retain 1031, but all these provisions can't be put into effect immediately. There has to be a transition period. And we don't know what that would be.
Thank you. The next question is from David in Lakewood, New Jersey. What about focusing our attack on the loss of interest deductibility? That change would be very unfavorable to small businesses in particular who must borrow money to make money. For any such business, interest is a very real and inevitable business expense.
This is Brent Abram. Absolutely agree with that. As we look at the ability to obtain capital from banks, small businesses tend to have a higher rate, obviously, or a harder time of borrowing it. But when they do, they need to borrow it. They also have they have less cash sitting in their own coffers. So they don't have cash sitting around their businesses. So to grow their businesses, especially if they're capital intensive, think of car rental companies, heavy equipment dealers, tractor trailer companies that need cash to acquire assets, going to a bank is their only option. When you look at a lot of the assets around the United States, there is a tremendous amount of debt associated with those assets being paid off monthly or daily from the income derived by those assets. So it is a very good point that interest is critical for small businesses to be able to deduct. Again, same thing, it's critical for individuals to be able to deduct their interest as well on their homes. Don't want to say that that's being thrown out there, but it's a similar parallel. It's very important as people look at, do I acquire a new asset? How much do I get to deduct off of my interest on a monthly basis?
Good.
It's a great point.
It's a good argument and I think an effective one. Now, I know that there are people out there with questions on what can I do? I mean, just exactly what template do I follow? Who's doing it? Who's currently doing it as a local QI? What are they doing? And I think Dave Brown is a great example of that. Dave, if you want to jump in and talk about your experience and what you've done locally, I'd appreciate it, and I'm sure the membership would too.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, we've been pretty successful in Iowa in terms of drumming up support for 1031 and reaching out to legislators through a number of efforts. And for those of you who are, you know, asking, you know, what can I do? Get out your pen and paper here. And I think we can also facilitate helping get all of you some resources to be able to utilize. But, I put together, my own little plan for what we'll be doing in Iowa specifically. And it starts, we're going to put together an alert. You all have relationships with your commercial realtors groups, Realtors Land Institute. Your different local associations and boards that have a strong interest in that. And a lot of you are leaders in the community, and they see you as a resource. So, one, you absolutely need to engage those boards. I'm going to send out an email request to the heads of those associations with a letter stating, here's the threat, here's what you need to do, please get engaged, please get on the field, as Dave has said. We're going to do that for the commercial folks, the farm folks, and other folks as all detail. But and we'll put together some text, we'll get the message that we'll put together for you to be able to send out your alerts and personal emails. I mean, I know we all have newsletters and emails blast, but personal emails to the people that you know, the heads of these organizations, the head of the large farm the large brokerages, whether they be farm or commercial or otherwise, reach out to them personally. Okay. The second thing that we're doing is we're getting academic and opinion leader support. So there are several economists that I know and have come acquainted with over my years in the business, who I'm going to ask them to put together op-eds and also reach out to the extent that they have connections. It can't just be coming from realtors. It needs to come from these academic and opinion leaders who are independent. So to the extent that you have connections with folks in your local market who can influence and would be willing to write that op-ed and submit it to the local, realtor publication. As an example, in Des Moines, we have the Des Moines Business Record. We also have the Iowa Farmer Today. We have DTN and Successful Farmer, their farm websites that we're working with. But any, you know, you all have metro real estate or business publications that you can push this stuff out to, and the more press and the more stuff we have hitting people to get them to connect with their members of Congress, the better. The other thing we're going to do is we're connecting with the big political donors and the large real estate owners around the state that we work with. You know, they all donate to their congresspersons. They have influence, and they have a dog in the fight. So you want to absolutely find out who are those people that have support, connect with them, and ask them to reach out. I'm speaking to there's a tax school for attorneys here toward the end of the month. I'll be speaking and addressing this issue with them. I'll be meeting with local boards, the State Association of Realtors, anybody I can get in front of to speak with, we'll be doing that. And then, of course, you know, you all have databases. You all, I mean, your database is full of the largest landowners in your local markets, and you need to use your database to send out alerts. And, you know, you can elect whether or not this is, appropriate for your business or not, but I intend to do a direct mailing just because I think this is such a critical issue to everybody in the database to try and hit that again. So, I think that there, you know, we can help sort of frame up some approaches that you can take and get you on the right path, but it's all in for everybody. You all have to engage, not just with dollars and not just with letting, others do the work. Everybody needs to be, as Dave said, on the field and in the game.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I think everyone on the call, I think it's note that we do have articulate and passionate defenders of our industry in D.C. working very hard. You've heard from them today. But our wider membership is equally powerful. And just because you're not going to D.C. or you can't go to D.C. does not mean that you cannot make a difference. You can. What matters a great deal to legislators is hearing from their constituents. It's one thing to hear from qualified intermediaries that, yes, our cause is noble, and yes, we care about our livelihoods, and yes, we do represent clients, but when those clients, those powerful landowners and asset owners, are reaching out on their own, and they have a sense of urgency in reaching out to those legislators, that's a next level of power that contributes to saving our industry. So I would encourage everyone, there'll be more data coming your way that you can speak to and you can share with your professional circles and with your legislators. But use it. We need you. Collectively, we're powerful. And just like Dave said, beyond the financial contributions that we need and we appreciate, your collective wisdom will help save this industry. We need your help. So, Lynn, any other questions?
Yes, we have quite a few more, and I just want to let everybody know on this call, if we don't get to your question before our hour is up, Steve Chacon has offered to respond to those questions in writing. Would you put us on mute, please, who's ever washing their hands, maybe? Question number 5, after immediate expensing, is the tax basis of property reduced, which then will trigger gain upon future sale that could not be deferred without a 1031 exchange?
That's sort of the reality that we're trying to paint to the authors of the blueprint and those that are writing the law, that there is a sophistication regarding business practices and the ownership of assets that they're missing, right? So that with full expensing, there could be potentially, especially as it relates to where you've got land and depreciable assets on top of that land, when you dispose of that, there's a gain that's not offset by full expensing. But also, yes, full expensing does create additional gains going forward. But the idea, I think, Brent, is that even if they're creating gains, future gains by full expensing, that as long as they're buying assets that are subject or eligible for full expensing, they'll just expense those and continue to offset that gain.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct. With that assumption that people continually,
that we continually, somebody please put your phone on mute. They continually grow. One of the concerns is this concept that people go out and acquire over what they actually need. And so, again, we're not going to be arguing expensing is not good, but people don't buy as routinely or as predictable when something's 100% expense. They may solve them for years, and, they may sell it. The other concern is at the state level, which we've seen in the past with bonus depreciation. Not all states recognize bonus depreciation and giving the ability to expense those items. So what we're looking at in the blueprint is federal taxes.
There could be states, and there probably will be states, that decouple from the federal law.
Absolutely, there'll be cut states. And so 1031, since they are routinely acknowledged at the state level, provided the deferral and reinvestment opportunities for companies worried about even state taxes. So it's another area that we don't have clarity on yet.
Yeah, but the bottom line is the assumption, as long as you're growing and buying, you can offset gains that are created through full expensing, right?
A second part of an earlier question is, wouldn't 100% expensing cause tax revenues to crater in year one?
Yes, but all of these are not, one of the things.
It absolutely would. We had a session with the Democratic ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee at a fundraiser. One of the folks said, what do you think about immediate expensing? He says, great, how in the world would you pay for it? So he answered that this is the same question. They're paying for it by the disallowance of interest deduction. The two are a matching pair both for revenue purposes and for tax subsidy purposes.
And, Dave, this is Max. My concern is that one of the problems that I see is that, if they get everybody on board with the immediate expensing, there's really nothing there to keep them. If they start looking at how are we going to pay for this and interest deductibility doesn't fill that gap, why not just do away with 1031 on real estate? They've got this bone they throw out to everybody, and they've got the big 12 or the big 10 all happy that they're getting their tax rates lowered, and there's a lower tax rate apparently across the board. So, I mean, this is not like a connect the dots deal. I mean, what you had mentioned earlier is that this is a wild card, and there's no guarantee that 1031 is going to survive it. Interest deductibility, immediate expensing, whatever else may be going on, 1031 is a small part of it. I think that.
Good point.
Another question. This is from John in Orange, California. If the immediate expense, in parentheses, accelerated depreciation, would be deductible against ordinary income, or would the passive loss rules still apply?
This is David. That's a $64,000 question. That's an issue that mine with the realtors and others in the real estate roundtable. There's no clarity on how they're going to handle that, they being the drafters of this legislation. It's just one more issue that the real estate lobby is focused on.
Moving on to the next question. Go ahead.
Excuse me, Lynn. Before we go to the next question, could Steve maybe talk to what people can do financially or the financial things that are going to change before we lose people? Because we're getting close to the end of the hour, and then you could pick up afterwards with more questions maybe. Thank you.
Yeah, we are pushing up against it now. Dues statements just recently went out, I believe, earlier this week. Correct, Lynn?
That's correct.
Good. So in that, please continue to be a member of the FEA and pay your dues as soon as you can. Those dues are the fuel that not only runs the FEA, but allows us to continue in this fight effectively, and we are effective. Okay. Secondly, you will receive shortly after this call a call for additional contributions to this fight. We spoke to it in the annual conference, the $5,000 challenge, and in that we're looking for an additional $5,000 from our members to fuel this fight. Okay, and that $5,000 can go just about any way, Brent, right? We can do some of it to the PAC and some of it to the FEA, or do we want to drive it all to the FEA?
Well, just be very clear how that PAC money is, right? It can't come from the company. So the $5,000 would just go to the FEA, and we would apply it to government affair activities, but not directly to the PAC.
So this is an FEA effort. This is strictly FEA. PAC, I'll get to the, I'll touch on the PAC shortly then. So this $5,000 challenge will be above and beyond your dues. And yes, it is a challenge. There are a number of ways, though, you can chop that up. If you can afford the $5,000, please send it all in. We can use it. We'll need to use it quickly because, as Dave said, this fight will, or this is going to happen quickly. They're drafting the law now, and being in front of drafting the legislative language and being part of that legislative language requires us to engage now as we are. You can send that in all at once, or if you wish to spread that out, please do. Think of it as a as an advance toward a future return on your investment in this industry. And frankly, for the larger qualified intermediaries, we know we can always count on them for that. For the smaller qualified intermediaries, I know it is painful, but think about what it does. It protects your livelihood, protects what you do, protects your client, and allows you to continue on in that particular role. So we need it. That money is the fuel. I can't say it any more clearly. It's what gets us to Washington. It's what helps us fund studies. And now these studies are critically important in explaining why 1031s impact the economy in a very positive way. They also explain why absent 1031s would impact the economy in a very negative way. It quantifies that in real terms for our legislators to understand. It also can help frame the argument, some of the arguments that we're talking about today regarding the non-deductibility of business interest, debt interest. So we need those funds to keep moving ahead effectively. Now together, using those funds and using our collective actions, just like Dave Brown spoke about, we can be successful. I'm feeling pretty optimistic about that. We have been proactive, more so than even other industries in regard to the House Republican blueprint. We have strong relationships with people that have authored the blueprint and strong relationships with those that are writing the tax law. And they've told us, keep coming to the table. So we need the money to keep coming to the table. So pay your dues as soon as you can. Think about how you can meet that $5,000 challenge, and I'm available for questions on that. Call me if you have questions. You're going to be receiving a statement on that shortly. And then also give to the PAC. That Political Action Committee fund is critical. It gets us access, direct access to fundraisers and legislators so we can talk about 1031s, why it matters to them, why it matters to their voting and contributing constituents, and why it matters to us. So there are a number of ways that you can help beyond physical action, and we need your physical action. But with financing, we can be successful. That's equally as important. So find a way to help financially and through action. With that, I think we're right up against it. We probably have time for one last question.
This is a question for Dave Franasiak. Senate budget reconciliation is limited to once a year for each of spending, debt limit, and revenues. Will any ACA, Obamacare, reform bill therefore properly be characterized as spending and then still allow tax reform bill the same year under revenues?
Let me clarify that. The way they're looking at this now, there'll be a leftover budget reconciliation from FY 2017, which we haven't really had a budget for 2017. They're going to do just a stopgap measure until March. But they are going to pass a budget resolution for 2017 that they'll create a budget reconciliation vehicle that will be on spending primarily, and it will be the Obamacare changes, including repealing Obamacare taxes. That's step one. Step two will be they will do a budget for 2018, pass a budget resolution, have budget instructions for at least two additional budget reconciliation bills. One will be for tax, which I assume is tax reform. The second will be for additional spending measures, probably cuts in programs, et cetera, et cetera. Hypothetically, they could do a third on the debt ceiling, although Congress having that authority has never employed it. Nobody knows how that would work. But technically, there's actually three in a year you could do. We've only ever seen them do two. In this case, we'll do a total of three, one from 2017 and two from 2018, the one in 17 being Obamacare slash spending, the two in 2018 being a spending budget reconciliation, number one, and a tax budget reconciliation platform, number two.
There are probably seven more questions out there.
Yeah, Lynn, it's real quick. I know that there's a question out there, and there's a part statement, too, from Steve. And Steve Robison, forgive me if I'm not getting your last name right, but you're exactly right. We've been making the argument about cost of capital increases under the blueprint and how it impacts small businesses versus very large, the wealthy, and that is a concern and something we've been addressing. So your thinking is right on. So with that, Lynn, we're right up against the hour. I know this is a very important topic. We're not finished with it. We'll certainly be following up with communications to the membership regarding financing this operation, also with additional written bullet points on how they can move into action. So we should probably go ahead and wrap it up.